Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Actor and playwright Emmett Kerwin, good afternoon.
Hey, you know.
Back. Always good to see Emmett. I always feel I have to up my game slightly now with you. So you're going to talk us through your life in five songs. You're a theatre and film person, obviously, but your work intersects with music a lot. So music's very important to you, is it?
Yeah, incredibly important, yeah. I think it informs most of the plays that I write. I'll often have a kind of musical soundtrack in my head, or because a lot of it's done to spoken word, I'd usually compose some of the pieces actually to the music that I'm listening to, you know.
Okay, so sometimes the music comes first and
Yeah, definitely.
Tell me a bit about growing up then. What were your parents like? Were they into music? Were they artsy, bohemian-y kind of people? Or?
Do you know what? They were both very much into music. My dad actually went to see the Beatles in
the Adelphi.
In the Adelphi. Yeah. And I'd ask him about it. He's like, what do you think of that? And I always remember him being so kind of nonplussed. He was like, oh, yeah. Because to him, he was born in 45. He's a huge Elvis fan. So to him, okay. I think he just thought they were four Elvis knockoffs, like a lot of people said they were. So he was very kind of nonplussed about that. But they, I know both my mum and dad would have went to what they call the bops and the dance halls kind of stuff. And then in terms of culture, it's funny because when I came along, obviously in the 80s, it was only in the 90s I actually figured out how both theatre literate both of them were, because they would have went to see a lot of plays, you know, when they were younger, because that was just such a kind of vital part, I suppose, of culture, you know, everyone's culture, you know, that they went to the theatre much more before, you know, they had four kids, you know. Yeah. So they were very much into music. They were into trad music and ballads. But my brothers were the ones that kind of brought the modern music into the house. So I was lucky because I was...
So you three older brothers.
Three older brothers, and they
have a similar story. They can be the source a lot of time. So what kind of music did they expose you to?
So my oldest brother... He was into like the Style Council and the Jam and kind of a lot of two-tone stuff. And then his taste obviously would have developed in like the later years into kind of house music and stuff. And then my other brother, the next one after that, Paul, he was into the House Martins, Beautiful South. A lot of that kind of, I was thinking about it during the week. I was like, you know that 1980s English white boy soul?
Yeah.
That kind of would have come around. And then you think of like level 4, not level 42 and stuff, but you know that kind of stuff that happened. So those groups like the House Martins, they were obviously heavily influenced by vocal groups from the 60s. They were into a lot of that. And then my brother, he would have been into stuff that would have been of his generation, which was late 80s, 90s.
This is your third brother.
Yeah. He was very much into dance music and kind of like, I remember like The Farm and Spiral Carpet, Stone Roses.
Oh yeah, Baggy.
Baggy, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And where that intersected then with that Manchester dance scene, you know?
Yeah, so all interrelated but different kind of musical tribes as well. Did they dress the part and all that kind of thing? Was the Style Council brother a bit of a mod and all that?
He was a bit of a mod. And then I was saying, it's my brother Kieran, he'll love me for this. He was a bit of a mod and he also looked a little bit like Rick Astley. He had the hair. And then my other brother, Paul, he was very much, he Fine Young Cannibals and Jimmy Somerville. My brother kind of dressed like Jimmy Somerville, bomber jacket and so forth.
Yeah.
And then my brother, definitely, Brian, he definitely would have dressed like that kind of early 90s, you know, Liverpool footballer kind of thing. That was the style, you know, that they all kind of had.
Okay, so your first choice today is the House Martins' Happy Hour. So what does this bring you back to?
This brings me back to my brother Paul, who was... Him and his friends actually would do harmonies from the B-sides off this in the house.
Right.
You know, so a bunch of Tala boys all singing like the B-side acapellas.
Like street corner in the projects kind of thing, guys harmonising,
I did it at a wedding. I start singing it or something at a wedding joke and I was like, oh, this song. And they corrected me. This was in the 2000s. They're like, no, it's not like that. And then they rocked into one of his friends, Gary, and another guy rocked into like a two-part harmony saying, you're singing it wrong. So I remember the House Martins because they were on all the time. My brother bought me my first tape album, which was a House Martins album, which maybe looking back was probably for him. But I made a point of actually holding it in my room and keeping on to it. So, you know, that was the music I was exposed to.
Okay, here's Emmett Kerwin's first choice, House Martins' Happy Hour.
What a good place to be. Don't believe her. Speak a different language and it's never really come to me. Don't believe her. Oh no.
The House Martins Happy Hour. I've forgotten how good it was, actually.
Yeah.
And of course, the seamless robe of all these things that you've alluded to, of how things develop. Fatboy Slim playing the bass there. So then, you know, that point comes where we kind of break a bit from the brothers and you know, want to just kick out and show our own independence. What was your musical tribe that you discovered yourself then or whatever?
I think in Tala, definitely in the late 80s, early 90s, there was two tribes, rockers and ravers, as opposed to rockers and mods, which maybe would have come before that. So you're really into Megadeth, you know, or Metallica or something like that, or you listen to dance music and kind of baggy, that thing. So I was really, I really gravitated towards dance music and house music, really. I don't know why, you know, it's house music. They go, what is it? I'll know it when I hear it, I really loved dance music, and that kind of became, I think that was the influence of my brother Brian. He loved it as well. So that really became the sound. And then I remember the effect of Britpop, like 94, and the release of Oasis's first album, Definitely Maybe, and how that shifted. You know, people started to rediscover more stuff from the earlier 90s, like The Firm and, you know, and Spiral Carpets and Stone Roses and so forth. Yeah. And that then
so
became...
In a way, like for the hip young things, rock was dead at that point, but Oasis kind of did, in a way, rejuvenated
it
that.
It did. Yeah. I remember kind of Guns N' Roses was a huge thing, and I remember dance music overtaking that. This is, you know, when I was about 11, and everybody listened to whatever was on the radio, obviously, but it was very much dance music. And then Oasis and Britpop made guitar music cool again, you know, and I remember that shift. And that kind of became the soundtrack, I think, then for the rest of my... the rest of my teens. I also did listen to American R&B music, modern 90s R&B music, but I wouldn't tell anyone that.
Yeah.
Kept that to myself.
So did you go, I'd be interested now in the way you're kind of a cultural critic and everything. Did you go to Oasis back in the day, and did you go to Oasis again recently?
I did, I went in 96 twice, went to Park of Cueve, and then I think I went to the Point as well. Yeah, Point, Park of Cueve, and then to the Point again in 97. And I know a few friends who went to those gigs. We were trying to reorganise to go now, dad rock, in our 40s, so I went, it was great. I went on the Saturday night, and it was incredible, you know. And it was like that. It was just an army of men my age, you know, and women, obviously, reliving the 90s, you know.
Yeah. Did you wear a bucket hat?
I didn't. Yeah. But I was saying this to someone, I don't remember the bucket hats in the 90s. The bucket hats were kind of like Mickey Mouse ears at the gig. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It was like
an
aesthetic or something that has been copied and replicated. That wasn't actually... You maybe wore a bucket hat in the 90s to be ironic. You know, one or two people had them. Whereas when I went on the Saturday, everyone had them. You know, child, adults. It was kind of mad. Yeah. It was like,
Like a fetishizing or commodifying.
It was, exactly,
That never really happened the first time around.
Yeah. Or if it did, it was very small, you know. So it kind of looked like Mickey Mouse ears. I was like, that's mad. They're everywhere, you know.
But you look, people were enjoying themselves.
Yeah, oh, no, listen, I'm not slagging. I'm just saying, it was just kind of funny to me.
Yeah. So the dance music then, and I suppose we would tend to associate you with dance music, most obviously the play in the film Dublin Old School. So tell me about discovering dance music and the excitement of that.
I think it was funny because discos, even when we were young, would have kind of had a harder edge to them in Tala, you know. So you would get people that would play. It wasn't just like disco. It wasn't just like radio pop hits. You would go to a disco in a local youth club at 12 or 13, and they'd be trying to replicate the music of rave culture, you know, that obviously kids our age couldn't go to. So you'd go to a disco. There's one called The Barn, which was beside St. Mark's School, where I went to school myself. And I remember the music there being quite heavy, you know, like it was techno, it was dance music. So that was kind of something that was, I suppose, transgressive in a way, you know, because it's like, are we supposed to be listening to stuff that's this hard, you know? And that was kind of a thing. I really liked that. Now, I did, you know, obviously like dance music as well. That was like house music that was much more kind of pop orientated. But yeah, that would have been one of the kind of gateways into that music. You know?
You felt there's something going on here. Like,
So the
song you've chosen next is Delight, Groovers in the Heart.
Yeah.
Which was kind of one of the first big hits of that kind of sample dance music and stuff, wasn't it?
I remember my brother Ciarán's 21st, and this was the track of that year, and that he would have listened to a lot of this kind of stuff, like, you know, house and I think it's like acid jazz or whatever they would have called it, one of those kind of, you know, titles they give music. But yeah, this was a huge track, and I just remember it being played on vinyl in the house when my brother's listening to it, you know.
Okay, here's Emmett Kerwin's second choice today. D-Light, Groove Is In The Heart.
My succotash wish.
Sing it, baby.
I couldn't ask for another. No, I couldn't ask for another.
There, that's Emmett Kerwin's second choice today, and anyone between what I would say 45 and 55, that instantly brought them back to a time and a place in their lives. So in your teens then, you got into Dublin Youth Theatre, and I feel that kind of opened up a whole world to you.
Yeah.
And that you would have met Philly McMahon from This Is Pop Baby at that stage. And did the two of you see music as a way to make the theatre kind of, to modernise it, make it relevant again or something?
Definitely. I think Philip and his company, This Is Pop Baby, it's literally in the title, that pop music and dance floors and music culture and the intersection between music culture and, for them, and the company Queer Culture and modern culture. That was a way in for people that maybe didn't always go to the theatre or want to go to the theatre, or something that might not feel as relevant maybe to younger people as music feels relevant.
Yeah.
So I think that was their thinking in terms of music that influenced them. And for me, I think music definitely was a way in to storytelling, because I listened to a lot of hip hop and I noticed how kind of people like Slick Rick or Tupac, or, you know, a lot of modern conscientious rappers in the early 90s would have told stories. So that was a huge influence for me.
Is there a class element to all of that for you as well?
For the storytelling?
For the idea of using like music, that a lot of that comes from kind of working class people, to get people who, like young working class people who mightn't have gone to the theatre and stuff?
I think so, yeah. Definitely with Dublin Old School, that would have been one of the, you know, wasn't the intended goal when you write it. But to make something saleable to people, it's like, look, there's something here that's as vibrant as a gig. Because when you did Dublin Old School, it was just two microphones on the stage. So it has that aesthetic of a hip-hop gig, but maybe a DJ in the background. So something that is presented as both theatre, but then also something that's recognisable.
This is the grammar you understand, the setup you understand and everything. Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah. So your next choice now is an Irish dance track, Sound Crowd, Energy Rush.
Yeah.
So paint me a picture of, were you there in that kind of early 90s Irish rave scene then?
I would have been too young. So I was literally, I think the first big dance event I went to was an under-18s thing in the Mansion House, which would have been played at by these kind of bands, you know.
Yeah.
And then there was a strange kind of weird thing that happened in Irish dance music where Scottish Hard House became huge.
Okay.
Ultimate Buzz and Ultrasonic. Anyone who's listening to this, maybe our age might know this. Yeah. It was a strange thing where Scottish rap over Hard House beats.
Okay.
So a lot of that, they'd come over and play under 18s gigs, which are kind of like baby raves, if that makes sense. So we would have went to a lot of those kind of things. And but the Sound Crowd would have been on Club FM and Freedom FM pirate radio stations, because they were an Irish act, Mark Kavanagh. And I just thought, you know, I was like, listen, I'm going to put a dance track in there.
Yeah.
They were and did make and played discos as well. This was saying about the hard edge. They played underage discos as well in places like Tala. So you would have got to see what the adults were seeing.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
In a,
yeah.
In a pre-8 under
and come here, what was the kind of buzz for you out of the whole that rave scene and those kind of gatherings stuff? What was the magic of it like?
I think the difference between what I know now to today is that a lot of like dance music, and this would have happened even when I was in my 20s, it's a lot of people, if you see Boiler Room, it's a lot of people facing a DJ. But I remember kind of a time when people weren't, the DJ was there somewhere off in the distance.
Yeah.
But people were just dancing with their friends, you know, in their own kind of section of the dance floor, you know, and it wasn't necessarily about everybody uniformly facing forward, you know, looking for the DJ.
Yeah,
it was more of a kind of, there's obviously this fun at all these gigs, but yeah, I just remember that aspect of it, like the different crowds coming together and you know, being with your friends.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people met a lot of unlikely people they wouldn't have met otherwise in their real lives as well, didn't they?
And it was a great unifier, the people from middle class backgrounds, working class backgrounds coming together, you know, in music, which still happens today and has always happened. But I think that was a real unifier, you know.
Okay, here's Song Crowd, Energy Rush. This is a great smorgasbord of music here. So that's the only time you're going to hear a Song Crowd on Radio 1 today, certainly.
Say,
Energy Rush. People might have thought they'd turned it down to a Talapurra station
might
from
be
the early
one of the reasons
90s
why
by
I
accident.
Picked it.
Yeah. Okay. And that was Emmett Kerwin I'm talking to. That was his third choice. So you mentioned hip-hop then, and your next choice is a hip-hop track. Like, in a way, like in another life, in another world, you probably could have been a rapper, couldn't you? Like some of what you do is not a million miles away from it, the rhythm and the language, lyrical flow to music and that.
I think in the way people imagine themselves maybe being a Liverpool footballer, you know, that kind of way, but not for real. You know what I mean? Like, I doubt it. No, it's just, it is something that has influenced work because it's not an obsession, but it's just something that you don't actually realise how much you've listened to it and how much it's a part of who you are until it starts to pop up in the work that you do, you know? So I think in that sense, yeah, definitely.
So was hip hop in there in the background all your life, yeah?
Yeah, definitely. And but to all my friends as well, you know, we listen to all these different genres of music, as most young people do. I don't think they're defined by one thing, but hip hop was always there. It was a huge, huge part. And a lot of, because we came up in that MTV generation when it came on TV when we were about 10, you got a few extra channels came on, and one of them was MTV, and people would record Yo MTV Raps, which was a late night thing, and then we'd swap tapes and stuff like that. So pre obviously internet, like, so that was, you came across these things. They're incredibly esoteric because they wouldn't make it into the Irish or UK charts, but you would know about them through MTV. So then you became hip hop literate from this show, you know, that was giving you music you wouldn't hear anywhere else.
And why have you chosen The Far Side and Running?
This, I remember this having a profound, there's a great video that was made to this by Spike Jones, who also made the Fatboy Slim video, Praise You. It was all done backwards. And I remember just being really struck by the visuals of it and then the lyrics, and knowing that I gravitated towards this type of hip hop specifically, a conscientious type of hip hop. Because at that time in 95, a lot of it was gangster hip hop. And I remember just thinking, I was wondering why I kept listening to Tribe Called Quest and De La Soul and these bands. And it's usually because there's a storytelling element to it and a confessional aspect to it, which I think is quite important for most playwrights and theatre makers, you know. So it's kind of a way of coming to literary pretension, I suppose, before actually sitting down with a novel, you know, at a time in your life.
Okay,
you know, 14,
so you wouldn't have been reading and stuff then. This was
I think, like, I would have been, but I think
this is how you were mainly, though, taking in words and poetry. Yeah,
I think so. I think I was reading, and definitely reading novels, but probably a lot of garbage. But like, this was something that actually, when tastes start to mature, you know, 13, 14, you know, I think I was reading Star Wars novels.
That was
the pinnacle of literary pretension I had, you know.
Okay, The Far Side, Running. They let the smoke come quicker than an evil redneck can lick a helpless color figure. And as a victim, I am really low key. Still, the keyhole itself got lower than me. So I stood up and in my free form, free. Said, I'm gonna get something before they knock it out me. I don't sweat it. I let the book blow in the breeze. In other words, just a breeze. Yeah. That's great, isn't it? The Far Side, Running, that's Emmett Kerwin's fourth choice today. It's interesting what you say about having to find all that music in places, and now, like, it's all just there for kids, like, which a lot of people give out about. But I think it's amazing that they you know, they can explore everything.
Yeah.
Remember, like, you'd have to save up, buy an album, all that kind of thing. It was a commitment, but now you can just try, they can try everything out.
And I think you can see that in how young Irish music artists are like light years ahead of where they were in the 80s and 90s. Like, yeah, obviously there was great success in the 80s and 90s, but they're incredibly musically literate. Is that the word I'm looking for? So you see all these various different influences,
yeah,
and there's,
yeah,
no,
there's
no kind of, oh, this isn't cool. They love everything, I think, yeah, I find with a lot of young artists.
You're going back to CDs though, are you?
I am, yeah.
Yeah.
I got a CD player.
Yeah.
I think we're all kind of reaching that thing where you go, I remember Spotify, for whatever reasons, it's just ethical kind of thing, I don't believe in it. A musician friend, actually, Brian Dillon, was telling me, you know, he uses Tidal, and he was like, you know, they're not paying artists. And I kind of took it on board what he said. But I just thought to myself, it's never going to go down. It's 16 quid now. It's going to be 20 quid in 2 years' time. It's like, when do we say, 30 quid, I'm done, you know? And as well, the way I think the AI works in it now, they're trying to feed you things, as opposed, there's no humans in the equation picking the playlists for you. And I think people are starting to notice that it's that the systems, these streaming systems, are getting worse. So I think, I've got all these CDs at home and it doesn't cost me anything to just go get them in my parents' house,
yeah,
to get them and just play them, and it's not going to cost me anything. So and hard media, I think, as well, just owning the thing, because albums can be deleted, films can be deleted, you know. So these digital records or digital catalogues that we have of music or film, they're not actually ours, they're all on license. So there's something about having the physical CD or vinyl, or, and I'm definitely going back to make a concerted effort to listen to it. Better fidelity as
well. It's back to, as well, keeping the House Martins tape in your room.
Yeah.
Because it mattered who owned it. Like, even if everyone listened to it, this is mine, and this is part of who I am, yeah. Come here, what are you up to at the moment?
Doing a play with Fish Amble Theatre Company, the new play company called The Leap by Gavin Costick. We're on in the Draught in Blanchestown for Dublin Theatre Festival. We're also doing some school shows as well in the run-up to that. It's the first young people's play that Fish Amble's ever done, and it's a beautiful piece about a father and daughter reconciling something that's happened, and it takes some Irish myth and fantasy, and it's quite relevant to what's happening now with modern day parenting and having to work and kids maybe being left at home when their folks have to go out, you know, on school holidays and stuff.
Okay.
So it's a lovely, beautifully written piece, and it's on in October.
You were, I think the last time we talked, you were kind of still in the shock of new fatherhood.
Yeah.
How's it all going now? Has it settled down?
We've child two now.
All right.
So,
just when you're getting used to it. Yeah.
So we're in that. We're back into that 100 yards there kind of moment. My poor wife is maybe more sleep deprived than I am. But yeah, it's great though.
Okay. So you're acting at the moment. Are you mainly a writer, an actor, a filmmaker now, or do you define yourself in those terms?
It's hard, yeah. Sometimes I go, I work primarily, and for the last 2 years I've been working as a playwright and a theatre artist, like a theatre actor. And but the main thing I've been doing for the last 2 years is writing. So I've been writing three plays kind of over the last 3 years there. One's going on this year, one's going on next year. I'm writing a play for the Gate Theatre, and I'm writing a play for This Is Pop Baby and Fish Amble, and then I'm writing a third play that I can't really talk about at the minute.
Okay, so you're a playwright now?
Yeah, mostly. And then I work in theatre then, as like a lot of the time I work as a writer-performer. So I'm doing Christmas Carol in the Gate later in the year, but I was like, I'd actually love to just do something and not have to write it.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I was like,
yeah.
I'd love to just show
just
up.
Just tell me where to stand or what to say.
Exactly. Yeah, so I was like, and that's my wife said that to me. She goes, this is going to be great. You're just going to walk in day one and someone's going to give you a script. Because trying to do both of those things is quite difficult.
Okay.
And the next two plays I'm writing, I won't be in. So that's a really nice thing to hand it over, you know.
Okay. Your final choice is for your wife, Ali. You met her through music, did you?
Yeah, we would have like went to all the same kind of gigs, you know, in our 20s. And I met Ali just after she came back from living in Barcelona, yeah. So we would have came together from the music that we listened to.
And this is the song, I believe, that you plan to walk down the aisle to. Wait till you hear it, she'll get a laugh. But what went wrong with that plan?
COVID. We were supposed to get married down in Cork during COVID, but the wedding would have fallen in right bang in the middle of the lockdown. My wife is a huge techno fan, and she was like, well, I just want to hear the music that I listened to at our wedding. I said, all right. So I think I was talking to one of the producers. I think they thought we were going to do some sort of coordinated dance down the aisle to this, but that's not the case.
Okay.
I actually don't know why it was. I just remember my wife saying, because I said I'd like a song for each of us, you know, family members or whatever. And she said, throw that in, that'd be good fun. It'd be good for everyone to listen to on a Sunday morning.
Okay, priests would have been scandalised. Okay. Emmett, you're going to be performing in that play. It's from Fish Amble, the new play company. And it's a new play for young audiences called The Leap. It'll be at the Dublin Theatre Festival from the 8th to the 12th of October. Emmett Kerwin, thank you very much.
Nice.
We'll finish up now on your final music choice today, right? So picture this walk down the aisle now. This is Tonight, Higher Ground. Thanks, Emmett.